Okay, thanks for having me. I'm going to talk about the latest sort of disk galaxy simulations that we've been doing at the N-Body shop. So I've recently used to move to the University of Central Lancashire on a SDFC fellowship, I think they're called. I did a lot of most of this work at University of Washington, where I finished a postdoc with Fabio and the rest of the N-Body shop team, as well as Beth, initially up there, which is starting to break up a little bit. And Greg Simpson is at McMaster. Allison is here. Okay, so what I'm going to talk about is sort of the next generation of simulations, where we start to get resolution of star forming regions to some crude degree, but it's a big step forward, as you'll see. This sort of results in some gas blowout, which we haven't seen before in these cosmological disk simulations, and you'll see that we end up with, in this low mass regime, faultless disk and a linearly rising rotation curve. If I've got time, I'll then talk about what I think the implications for this are for the Milky Way, because that's what we're all doing here. And I'll just talk about the populations, what we know about the populations in these simulations in general, of accreted population and an in-situ star population. Okay? And we'll try and infer what these new simulations are saying, what we know from the old simulations, between the difference between these two populations and their relationship to the galactic components. Okay, so what are these simulations? Just to remind everybody who doesn't know, we have parallel chemodynamical galaxy evolution code. Okay, so it models gravity for a start, for the dark matter and the stars. We include gas hydrodynamics, UV background radiation, that's included. We have Compton and radiative cooling, and in this particular simulation, we have some low temperature cooling from metal lines. We have formed stars when the gas meets certain criteria, and we just make a power law relation with the density of the stars to make a star formation rate. And then we blow up supernovas and deposit some energy into the surrounding gas. This is going to be an important part of what you'll see in the simulation. And Greg Stinson did a lot of work developing this supernova feedback recipe that we use. We're resolving not individual supernova, because we don't have the resolution to do that. So it's like we're resolving an overlapping population of supernova and seeing the blow wave, the blast wave, or the super bubbles, and now like what we see in the Large Magellanic Cloud or in other dwarf galaxies in the Ting survey. That's the sort of resolution that we're inputting supernova feedback. And then we follow some basic chemicals in this code, hydrogen, helium, oxygen, to get an idea of supernova type 2, enrichment, and iron. But I won't really show any of the results from that in this particular talk. So far, as I say, star formation regions are not resolved. We have, in the simulations to date, what we generally do is we have a low amount of star formation spread over the disk. We have a very low star formation density threshold. Okay? And we have to do that, because otherwise we don't resolve these differences, these fine differences in density in the disk of these galaxies. So if we don't do that, the only star formation that would go on is right in the very central couple of kiloparsecs. Okay? Because SPH by its nature smooths over density regions. So we have to have a low density. We just have star formation sort of bubbling away in a low rate, right? But what we're getting to now, when we simulate dwarf galaxies, is that we can actually resolve molecular cloud masses. So we're getting sort of a few tens of the three solar mass particles, meaning that we can resolve things that are around 10 to the 6 solar masses. And the difference is, now we can start to see dense and low density regions in sort of spiral arms and in the outer parts of the disk galaxy. So we can actually see the gas collapse into denser regions in amongst the lower density gas. So what we can now do is start to change our star formation parameters to only form stars in these high dense collapsing regions of gas. This means that we've upped the star formation density threshold in these latest simulations. Okay. As I say, star formation, the mass resolution is a few 10 to the 3 solar masses. Gravitational softening is a little in parsec. Okay, and Grant Robinson will give a talk tomorrow also talking about the next step in improving these star formation recipes when we can do things at this resolution. Okay. So, this is some initial conditions. It's just a dwarf that we've set up. It's a pure disk dwarf. So it's an isolated galaxy. I've got the two different star formation parameters. One is low density threshold and low star formation efficiency. And here we've got a high star formation threshold, high star formation efficiency. Just to highlight what I was saying, the difference in the way star formation occurs between these old simulations, the old recipes we're using, where you'll see when I start it, star formation sort of bubbles away in this low density gas, right? And it has, star formation is actually quite rapid. There's a lot of star formation going on all throughout the disk. Whereas in here, you'll see these little regions collapse. You can see these little dead gas clouds, and that's where the star formation occurs in these new simulations. Right. Thinking about it. Okay.
What's the carbon bar?
So this is gas and this is stars. And you know, the blue, the young stars are blue. Okay, so as you see over here, gas collapses into these little clumps and you can see the stars forming in those clumps. Over here, gas, the star formation recipe is that this low density gas is forming stars. It's just bubbling away in the disk. Right, so star formation is really spread throughout the disk and it's forming these, just in these low density regions. You can see the supernova bubbles and there's not a huge amount of difference in the scale of the bubbles that are being blown in the two simulations.
Are supernovas driven or dynamically?
They're supernova driven, yeah.
Do these bubbles look like real bubbles?
Two first order, but I haven't measured them in detail, and it's something that I really need to do, for sure. Yeah, we'll get to that, yeah. No, yeah, this is just an isolated disk, but we'll get to it. Yeah, exactly. And in fact, there is over here, this one actually forms a bar and forms a bowl, but that's a separate issue because it runs out of gas, so it's unstable. Okay, so here's a cosmological run. This is what happens when we put it into full cosmological run, same resolution. Okay, the early things that are collapsing, you can see, are starting to blow gas out of the low, small potential wells of the early collapsing halo. Okay? This has got the full merger history, so it's not an unusually quiet merger history, this galaxy. It's got a very normal merger history. You can see gas getting streaming in, and you can also see bubbles blowing gas out of the galaxy. Yeah, that's a good question. I think it's about 25 kiloparsecs across, but these movies are done on the fly, and I never quite really know what it is. We make these movies on the fly, and anyway. So this won't be the... Actually, I've got 2.5 of these galaxies run, and I've only analysed one of them. This is the second one that I've run that I haven't analysed yet, and the reason is that, for the same reason, the first one I did, I had the parameters wrong for making the movie, and you can't see as much. Second time, I could get them right. You can see the star formation really is by redshift 1 or so. Star formation is in the central disk, and we've got these huge H1 disk surrounding it. Okay, so I didn't quite get the parameters right because you should be able to see all the stars forming in here, which you can't really.
Right, so this is accreting gas.
Yep. Right. This is a full cosmological simulation.
Tell us how much mass is gaining
into redshift 1. Into redshift 1, I'll show you at some point.
It's doubling
in
mass
or what? In baryons. I think I'll show you something. But yeah, I mean, I can calculate that if I don't show you easily. Yes? For sure. Okay. This is just a gas, basically. It should show stars, but it didn't. But the stars are confined into this central region. This one has got a very extended gas disk, and in fact, the one that I'm going to analyse hasn't got quite as extended gas disk. And you'll see that in the Patreon plots that I make. I haven't analysed that yet. Yeah, I know. In this particular one, it looks like it. And I haven't even looked at this. Yeah. This is just a cosmic. There's many things I haven't looked at yet. Believe me. Everyone asks me that. So this is what it looks like at redshift zero anyway, in the I-band, face on and edge on. It's got a luminosity in the I-band, I mean a magnitude of about -17.4. It's rotating at about 50 kilometres per second. Right, so I think it fits somewhere near the Tully-Fisher. It's got a H1 mass to luminosity in the B-band of around 1. Right. It's blown out a lot of its baryons. This is something that I've never seen before in any of the cosmological simulations that I've run before. Usually the baryon fraction at redshift zero is universal. In these type of simulations here, we're blowing out a little over half the baryon. Right, and it's blue. Sorry? That's in the virial radius. Yeah. Baryon's a dark matter fraction, yeah. Mass. Yes. Yeah. Okay, so here's something to do with how much light we actually get. We've got the outflow rate over here as a function of time in the simulation. And you can see it varies between about 0.1 and 0.5 solar masses per year getting blown out of this dwarf galaxy. Right? And when I use the old recipes for the same simulation, it's an order of magnitude less blowout. And this is probably in the noise of the way I'm calculating blowout anyway.
Are these just wide winds or nuclear winds?
You'll see they are. Yeah. So early on it's coming from the centre. But as I'll show in a simulation, in a movie in a minute, you'll see some blowout from the disk and you'll be happy. Anyway. Yeah, maybe not. We'll see. Okay, so here I've plotted the outflow fraction, which means because the galaxy was obviously lower mass at high redshift, right? What fraction of that mass is going to get blown out per giga-year? That's what this says. So up here it says the outflow rate peaks at around, after redshift 1. But you've got to understand that this galaxy is in a few different little pieces. So the outflow rate, normalised by the mass of the galaxy at that time, is higher at high redshift. So you're blowing out a higher fraction of your gas from the lower potential well, which is what you expect. Okay? So I think this is important in how we're avoiding making a bulge in this galaxy. So I think the bulge is, in these simulations, is largely forming in the way that Rosie was talking about, which is these cold flows coming in and gas coming in at high redshift and forming stars in the central, the largest dark matter halo of the merger tree, so the central galaxy, basically. All right? So that's what we're sort of really putting a halt to. We're blowing out this stuff. Because the gas that comes in at the start obviously is being torqued less than the gas that comes in later. So you've got this low torque material, low angular momentum material coming into the centre of the galaxy at early times. Right, and this is forming a bulge in these simulations. And if we can blow a lot of that out, then that seems to be what's happening. There's some other effects of bulge formation, like, okay, so we're keeping the disk's gas rich, and if you look at the latest Hopkins paper, for example, if you merge gas-rich disks, right, then the more gas-rich they are, the smaller bulge that will be created in that merger. Right, so if you have a disk with a little low amount of gas in there and you have a merger, you'll end up driving more of the gas to the centre and forming a bulge, a larger bulge. So there's a few factors, but I think the main one is this idea of blowing out the low angular momentum gas at the high redshift. And here's the mass loading. So this is the mass outflow divided by the star formation rate. And it varies somewhere between 1 and 10 during the lifetime of the dwarf.
Yeah. Why does it pick up?
Yeah, I haven't looked into that enough. And these probably jump around more the way that it's... I believe these probably should be more averaged out. The way that I'm picking it out is not exact. But the total amount would be about the same. But it does jump around more than I thought. And I haven't looked into where this increase comes from. Okay, so this is for Josh. This is the latest, the third of the simulations, like I said. I've done three of these. This one's only run to redshift 0.5 or 0.6 so far. But I thought it was interesting because the movie, as I said, we do it on the fly, happened to go edge on at this point. So this is just, I'm going to run it in slow motion just to see what's happening at the edge on disk with these supernovae. So hopefully we'll see some of these bubbles like that, okay, coming out of the disk plane. So, I mean, it's hard to judge sort of where this gas is going, if it's inflowing or outflowing, but you can definitely see these shells coming out of the disk. Right, up here again. So we are blowing gas. It's quite turbulent. These things are blowing gas out and out of the galaxy, some of it out of the galaxy. Right, we might see one more shell being formed, I think, at the end. There. We've got hot gas and cold gas, but it's not in the same particle. Yeah. So, yes and no. What do you mean?
It's not a molten space in the
Well, it's got hot and cold gas, I mean, but I don't know what true sense of any simulation is molten phase, so.
Oh, molten gas is just cold and hot.
Yeah. Well, I mean, each particle has, gas particle has a temperature, right? And it gets heated by a supernova.
Do you see a very confined hot halo, for example? And do you see the wind gas bending into the hot halo?
I haven't looked at that, though. But there will be, yeah, there'll be hot gas around here that it's blowing into, yeah. Actually, from there. So here, you can see this last bubble here. So, yeah, something. Okay, so it looks pretty wild in there. So, you know, is this thing just a complete mess? It looks like no, right? So here's the H1 column density map, redshift 0, H1 velocity field. This is Adrian Stilt, who's a grad student at UW, has made this plot. H1 dispersion, right? So if you look at the line profile, face on, it's got a very, like, 3 kilometers per second, something like that. In the H1 dispersion. So it's got a very cold gas disk, despite the fact that we've got these supernova blowing. Sorry? That's face on. H1 cold gas. Well, it's around 3. It's dominated by stuff in here. Yeah. Yeah, some of the gas. Yeah. Okay, and then we can measure the surface brightness profile. And as I said, I guess on the abstract, it doesn't really have a bulge. And I can do this with a slit or with an averaged over annuli. Right. And the other thing is the rotation curve. Generally, I don't know, these simulations, when we get a bulge, I don't know if people will know this, but generally the rotation curve looks like this. It's very, got this, everyone see that? Anyway, it's got an inner part peak, okay, and then it drops. And this is partly to do with this whole idea of it's tied up with the whole angular momentum problem. It's to do with the early gas flows going right into the centre of the galaxy. So we're getting around this problem as well, right? And I mean, it's all the same problem, really, in a sense. Okay, so rotation curve is seen in here in red, and I can follow it all the way out to like half the view radius, and it's flat in this particular galaxy. We sent the simulation to George Rhee, who made a tilted ring model, and he sent back this rotation curve from the cold gas in the blue. You can see the blue crosses. So just to sort of highlight that it's pretty close to linear out to two scalars. The dark matter halo?
Yeah,
I haven't measured that. Yeah, no, I haven't measured it. Oh, right, yeah. Oh, so the gas is not. Exactly. And there's some pressure from the supernova. Right. So I don't know how I'm going for time, but conclusions so far on these new simulations are that resolving star formation regions is the next step in these galaxy formation simulations. Gas blowout arises naturally with our supernova recipe. I didn't change anything about that. I just changed the density threshold of our star formation. We seem to eject low angular momentum gas from the high redshift cold-hot. That seems to be the key in what's making this galaxy evolve us at the end. As well as, you know, there's some implications for what happens when it merges as well. Okay, it's Stinson et al. 2006, Stinson 2006, yeah, and so what happens? Okay, so we put in like 40% of the energy is put into thermal energy around.
Sure.
Okay, and then there's a recipe for turning off cooling.
Okay.
Yeah. But that 40 is also dependent on the IMF. If we, anyway, that's another story. But it's a reasonable. Yeah. Okay, and so basically we're getting some promising results on two outstanding problems, which is formation of Bolger's disk and linearly rising rotation curves. Okay. So because we're talking about the Milky Way, I thought I'd try and tie this in. What are the implications for how we interpret these simulations when we talk about Milky Way formation and how the components of the Milky Way are formed? So basically I'm going to look at some of our old simulations and say, okay, let's look at the accreted versus the in-situ populations and what are the relationship to the stellar components of the Milky Way. Is there a feedback-dependent recipe? Because we're changing our feedback, or the effects of our feedback are changing in our new simulation, right? And I probably won't talk about whether there's a mass dependence because we'll run out of time. Okay, so going back a step, here we've got thermal feedback, which is sort of the original way that people put in feedback, which was just dump thermal energy into gas surrounding a supernova. Right? But we knew that supernova were occurring in dense regions, so we knew that the gas surrounding the supernova was dense. So what happened was that the gas would just cool away all the energy, cool quickly, and so the effect of the thermal feedback was negligible. And this has been this had many implications, which I'll talk about. One of them is to do with, so basically stars formed rapidly in the things as they collapsed before they merged, and one of the consequences was we were losing angular momentum rapidly to dynamical friction. Right? So people have tried to do new ways of implementing feedback from supernova that are more effective, basically. And that's what this feedback simulation recipe that I was talking about that we have here. And if you look at a low-mass galaxy, isolated galaxy, basically you're cutting off star formation at the early time, where in the old recipes you basically just form a whole lot of stars in early collapsing halo. So same thing as what I was talking about before, but the effect here was not quite as high. We also showed that this changing feedback recipes is essential in forming low-mass, low-metallicity stellar halos. As you can see, showed this morning, okay, with the old recipes, what you get is a massive stellar halo. Right? That's what people were getting in the early simulations. And it also has the implication that early mergers are gas-rich, and this has implications for thick disk formation, as we wrote a couple of papers, 2004, 2005, Grant has done a lot of work on these gas-rich mergers and the implications for this faulty formation. And as far as the bulge goes, there's a recent paper on Hopkins on the importance of keeping mergers gas-rich for making a bulge from during mergers. Right? Allison did some work on the importance of regulating star formation in these low-mass things and the importance of that for the mass metallicity relationship. So there's many reasons why we think that we need to regulate star formation in low-mass progenitors of Milky Way-type galaxies in these simulations and more generally. All right, so here I just plotted in-situ stars, accreted stars, right, using the same luminosity magnitude for reflective scaling here. So this is the total galaxy of one of our Milky Way simulations using the blast rate feedback. So I rescale the accreted stars and move out to 30 and 60 and 200 kiloparsecs. You can see that the accreted stars make the extended stellar halo, right? And obviously the in-situ stars make the disk and the bulge, right? So I'm talking about first order effects. There are second order effects, and you can see in the poster by Adi, who talks about some of the in-situ stars that actually get knocked up into the halo, right? And I think Rosie talked about the idea of accreted stars ending up in the bulge. And I'm sure Scott Tremaine will correct me if I'm wrong, but I think that's the second order effect of the bulge formation. So it's not the dominant thing that we think of as making the bulge, right? But the first order, really, in-situ stars dominate the disk, the thick disk and the bulge. Accreted stars dominate the halo. Right, and just to look at the bulge, this is the surface brightness profile in the dome above the plane in the centre of the galaxy, and you can see that really it is the in-situ stars which make the high-density bulge, and the accreted stars are really just in the extended stellar halo. So what are the effects of those two different feedback recipes? Basically, they change the ratio of the accreted stars versus in-situ stars. So that's the main effect we're having, right? So if you increase the number of accreted stars and decrease the number of in-situ stars, then you increase the size of your stellar halo and you decrease the size of your disk, right? But the properties of those two populations aren't all that different. So even though we've got, so these are the two different simulations. One simulation is the old recipes, thermal feedback in the crosses, right? And these are the accreted stars, and there's a lot more accreted stars here. But the accreted stars still, if you plot rotational velocity versus height above the plane in the solar neighbourhood, right, then the accreted stars, there's no gradient. But the in-situ stars in both simulations, there's a nice gradient where the disk stars close to the plane are rotating faster than the disk slash thick disk stars that are further away from the plane. So the idea is that that what you're really doing when you change these recipes and you change the number of accreted versus in-situ stars is you're not changing the properties of those two things, you're just changing the ratio in a lot of senses between stellar halo versus stellar disk. Right? So, just to prove that I can look through the literature and find observations that support my theory, I've found this is one of Yoko's plots showing, you know, this is a metallicity cut rather than thick of melted accreted. So this is supposedly the high metallicity stars from the SDSS sample as you go above the plane, and you can see that the high metallicity stars have a gradient as you go above the plane in rotational velocity, whereas the low metallicity stars, which are presumably the halo and presumably were accreted, don't have that same gradient. So I'm going to end there.
Chris, yeah. You mentioned that you had metal line cooling so you could get below 10 to the 4 Kelvin?
Yeah, that's in the dwarf, not in the... Yeah.
Just in the dwarf, not in the cosmological simulation. Yeah. And so how cold can the gas get?
Down to 20.
Down to 20?
I think so.
So just as a comment, if you look at the morphology...
Is that right, Alison? Yeah, I don't know.
Just looking at the morphology of the dwarf with the metal line cooling, there are clumps in the gas, and you're very likely not resolving the genes mass in that gas.
Okay.
And there's a known problem with SPH where you can get numerical fragmentation if you don't resolve the genes mass. At 20 Kelvin, there's no way that you're doing that.
Okay.
And so that you have to be careful about whether or not that fragmentation is correct.
Yeah.
So I was a little concerned in your star formation recipe by your statement that you're using efficient star formation with your high threshold. And the reason is that observationally we know that star formation is not efficient in any sense of the word, even at densities as high as 10 to the 5 per cubic centimeter.
Okay.
And certainly, you know, so if you're resolving molecular clouds with a mean density of 100, we know that molecular clouds turn themselves into stars at a rate of, you know, a couple percent of their mass per free fall time, and that they, over their full lives, turn only 5 or 10% of their mass into stars. So I'm wondering, what prescription are you using when you say efficient, and does that influence your results?
Yeah, probably, but all we'd really do is calibrate this so that we match the local star formation rate in the Milky Way in an isolated piece, right? Okay,
but what is the prescription that you're using?
So, well, it's just we just have a density goes as the star, star formation rate goes as the density over the dynamical time.
Right, I'm asking what the coefficient in front is.
Yeah, it's like 0.1, 10%.
Okay, that's definitely higher than we observe in the local universe.
Resolution is lower than nature is, so it has to compensate somehow.
But I would like to talk to you about this. Can we talk about this later in the week?
I was just wanting to comment that the overwhelming majority of stars in the Milky Way did, I think, form in situ.
Uh-huh.
And so I think models are going to have to match that. You know, that's the bulge, the thin disk, and the thick disk formed in situ.
Yeah,
so I
agree.
Certainly agree with that.
So I have a question about the metallicity distribution function of the currently observed dwarfs compared to this dwarf that you'd see. So you've got all this feedback sort of blowing out stuff. Can you actually reproduce these broad metallicity distribution functions that go all the way down to -3? I mean, is that possible?
We'll do it this week. Yeah.
This week? Excellent.
Yeah, we'll look at that. Excellent idea.
Okay, so I asked Matthias this morning about the Abadi et al. Simulations, and they formed a significant fraction of the thick disk via accretion. And I asked him again. He said he's run. I'm going to quote Matthias here. I'll just make it up.
Yeah.
All his disks are accreted and yours aren't. So, you know, that's an overstatement of the problem. But you're both running SPH simulations, so what's going on?
Well, it was what I was saying before. Matthias had a large spheroid, so he had so much accretion that you get an overlap between your spheroid and your disk star kinematic, right? So if you have a kinematic prescription for picking out disk stars, then there's always some overlap, right? And so if your spheroid completely dominates, then you get this huge overlap into the thickest region. So if you bring that down. So, I mean, it seems to be saying, though, that the spheroid and the thick disk are the same population. Doesn't make any sense. That's what I'm saying. So, but if they're all accreted, why are they different? That's the question. But it's to do with the mass of the spheroid. Does this make not make sense?
Yeah, okay.
It's because
their dwarfs coming in the sky.
Yeah, my dwarfs are coming in as gas, Matisse's are coming in as star, right? And so, but the hard thing is to make a thick disk from accretion without also making a spheroid, is the point. So it might be able to happen, but I haven't seen it happen in a simulation. So I've seen thick disks made by accretion, but you always get this thick spheroid as well. And that's what happens.
Hello. I have a question about your feedback recipe. Yeah. Since for this dwarf that you showed, that the key is just blowing up a big amount of the virus, you think that with the same recipe you could do the same in a bigger halo? Larger mass. Would it be that effective?
We've started running a Milky Way and so we'll see. Yeah. Okay. So, but it's very important that these recipes scale well if you've got the mass, right? And at some point, it's got to not blow out stuff because you want an elliptical to form stars rapidly still. So you don't want to completely mess that up. But that's going to be important. That it's hard to do a bigger mass thing because you want that same resolution. We can't do it.
You had a plot which I took to mean that your resulting stellar disk had a radial profile that was quite beautifully exponential. Is that?
Yeah.
Beyond that it just comes out that way, is it clear to which extent both the scale length and the exponentialness reflects, what does it reflect? Initial angle momentum distribution of the baryons, star formation efficiency, what is it that it comes out exponential?
I will look at the details of the angular momentum distribution, but I haven't done it yet. I've got code that I've done it on other galaxies that I haven't applied to, and I really can't answer your question.
So my understanding is that you're not using the Bate and Burkert resolution criterion, so that you may be having some artificial fragmentation, which is probably why when you look at these face-on images, they look very clumpy, right? Aside from this, I guess the other thing that this could be affecting is, you know, how much gas is being ejected by the supernovae. If it's very clumpy, that since that is directly tied to this resolution issue, I mean, I'm just wondering, what sorts of things do you think this might be affecting?
What do I think it might be affecting?
A lot of it.
Yeah, I don't know. I mean.
Chris, so you quoted the gas fraction of 0.067, right?
Yeah, I think it's
was it with respect to the universal fraction or was it absolute?
That was absolute. So the universal fraction started at 0.15 or something.
0.15, so
half of the baryons.
So half of the baryons are blowing up.
Yeah.
Do you think the galaxy would still lie on the baryonic Tully Fisher relation?
The baryonic Tully Fisher? I don't know. Can we do that in our head? I mean, it falls somewhere near the luminosity Tully Fisher, but. Yeah, but that's a luminosity, yeah. Yeah. So, but the baryonic, I'd say, I guess, yes.
Chris, you mentioned the bulgeless galaxies, and then you showed this profile, the light profile that seemed, you know, very non-exponential.
Uh-huh.
Could you put that again?
Yeah.
Is that the same simulation? Is that a different simulation, or?
No, that's the simulation. That's it. This galaxy.
I'm thinking of the one you had the accreted star profile, which looked exponential, and then the actual disk profile, in situ profile, which looked very non-exponential.
Oh, accreted in situ. I don't think I showed any.
You showed it. It was one of the last three or four
slides. No. That was something else.
That something different?
Yeah. I only showed the velocity.
No, I'm not talking about velocity. I'm talking about the light profile.
Yeah, no, I didn't show any. Oh, you mean?
I do remember you showing it. This is a different. I think it was this one. I think it was the one before.
Oh, right. Sorry. This is in the central region.
Yeah, is this the same simulation?
This is the Milky Way. No, this is a Milky Way.
No, this is a totally different one.
Yeah, this is totally.
So when you talk about bulgeless, you only talked about this dwarf.
Yes.
The dwarf simulation
itself. Yeah.
What is the bulge to disk ratio on this one?
If you were to do a Doppler
plus exponential.
Milky Way one. I can't remember, sorry, but it has got a significant bulge. This is height above the central, the bulge.
You didn't show the
radio? Ah, no, I got that from the
So you said, I think, at the beginning that you follow Fe and O elements. Can you see the distribution of those in the galaxy? So what's the distribution of metallicity and abundance patterns?
Yeah, we can. Alison and I have done some work on this, but we've only just actually put in... One of the things is the metallicity distribution is a big problem in these simulations. Because before, with these simulations that I have results for, we didn't have metal dispersion in the data. So you had these huge discrepancies in the metal. And now we're actually... So what that meant was... If you blew a gas from one region to another where there was a lot of metal, that gas retained its metallicity. And so what you need to do is disperse, make an average in regions, and so it made a big difference.
So, these new simulations you're doing
new simulations
have that.
Have got this, yeah.
Okay.
So we're going to do some new ones here.
You said that the disk stars and the bulge stars were formed in situ from gas, and the spheroid was from accretion. And my question is, did the gas which formed the disk and the bulge come in with the satellites that were accreted in the halo, or are you thinking it's more like a monolithic collapse?
No, okay, so Allison has got a paper about this, and most of the gas comes in smoothly. Most of the gas comes in smoothly. Some gas comes in clumpy.
So it's a monolithic
collapse.
There is
clumpy gas. Well, not exactly. There's cold flows coming in, but yeah.
For the Milky Way galaxy that I looked at, so it has a fairly quiescent history, 70% of the gas is actually coming in as smooth accretion. So coming in cold in filaments or just sort of a general sort of ambient sort of smooth flow, and it's only like 25% of the stars form from gas that's coming in mergers.
Okay, so I have a question also. Yep. So you did one simulation which had crappy resolution, came out crappy, and then you did another simulation which had better resolution, came out better. But do you have any idea?
We've been doing that for years, haven't we?
Do you have any idea how things would work out if you improve the resolution yet again? I mean, do you think there would be qualitative changes, and do you have any plan
for
doing
that? I mean, Brant's doing some stuff on star formation and things like that. At some point, we've got to improve the way star formation is done in these things. And I mean, as people have been studying star formation on small patches, so we've got to try and hopefully get the resolution that people are getting better star formation recipes than we have, and putting that into a cosmological context. So
I thought your comment was when your results go away with resolution.
Yeah, well, that's another question too, right? And because but the nature of our feedback, right, is resolution dependent. Exactly. No.
The nature of complex systems, you keep on evolving it wherever it matches. But of course, by definition, you keep on going beyond where you are now.
And some of the things that we do, we'll have to change and do it differently to get the effects on the resolution that we get.
So we have time for one more question, if need be. If not, let's thank our speaker. So next up is Raja.